You're listening to the Transnational Black Feminisms Podcast, co-hosted by Tammy Navarro and Premila Nadison at the Center for the Study of Social Difference at Columbia University and Barnard College.
At Barnard College, Columbia University. I am the co-director of a working group at the Center for the Study of Social Difference called Transnational Black Feminisms. And I'm here today with Robin Spencer. Good afternoon, Robin.
Good afternoon. I'm so happy to be here.
So we're happy to have you here, Robin. Can you start by telling me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a historian. I'm currently working at the City University of New York, Lehman College in the Bronx in New York, where I teach courses on 20th century African American history, Black women's history as well. My research focuses on Black power, Black women, Black feminism. I've written a book on the Black Panther Party. I'm doing research on the movement against the U.S. war in Vietnam, as well as some biographies of some amazing radical women.
Great. Can you tell me a little bit about how your work connects to or ways in which you have been thinking about transnational Black feminisms?
That's a great question. My work looks at, especially the biographies of women. I'm looking at the biography of Angela Davis and the biography of Patricia Murphy Robinson, both radical thinkers, activists, people who've left an amazing legacy for generations of struggle. One woman very well known, one woman relatively unknown. And so when I'm looking at and focusing on Pat Robinson's life, I'm looking at her ability to kind of actualize ideals about global solidarity in her life, in her political practice as a creator of organizations, in her work. She was a therapist, so she worked in particular counseling young women. She was based in New York in Westchester County. She worked in Mount Vernon and New Rochelle, and she worked with women, talking to them about birth control, talking to them about their interpersonal relationships, whatever was going on in their lives, their need for childcare. And she found ways of connecting those issues to larger questions of colonialism, patriarchy, capitalism, and really mobilizing them in new ways that I think that more people need to know about. Because I sometimes feel like when we think about transnational political thought or Black women's roles in it, it seems kind of theoretical and in the sky, but here's somebody, you know, talking to her neighbors, talking to young people that she met in her life that she was babysitting for, and mobilizing with and alongside those people to do things like protest against the Vietnam War, right? So I think it really speaks to the type of education that was part of transnational Black feminism, the way that it operated on a neighborhood and hyper-local level, the ways that it was connected to things like consciousness raising and the interior life of people that we tend not to sort of situate as political when we think about how and when and where does politics happen.
That's fascinating, especially as we think about, as you mentioned, somebody like Angela Davis, who was known internationally, and someone like Pat Robinson, who was known but not as well known as Angela Davis, and thinking about the multiple scales on which transnational Black feminism was practiced. Mm-hmm. Can you give, for listeners who might not know who Pat Robinson was, in what time period she was operating, how she came to activism, why she came to activism?
Mm-hmm. Well, Pat Robinson was born in 1926. She was part of the Murphy family. So she was born Patricia Murphy, Patricia May Murphy. Lots of Mays added in names in this period. And she was part of the Black elite. She grew up, I think, kind of scaffolded in particular ways, despite the terror of the time and the racial violence. Her family, which was consisted of people who considered themselves to be race men and race women, really tried to figure out ways to shield themselves from the harshest blows of white supremacy in that period. So for her, that meant that she attended the best school. She appears in the society columns of newspapers, attending birthday parties when she's three. Her wedding is held in the biggest church and 300 people attend, and she's wearing, you know, the best and the most expensive attire. And she could have had the kind of storybook, you know, to the extent that Jim Crow America allowed Black people to have that. But she could have, you know, especially as a lighter-skinned woman who had all of the financial trappings, she could have gone off in a very different kind of direction, just fighting against racism, but not necessarily seeing class, seeing colonialism, seeing imperialism. Her uncle, George Murphy, who was a radical activist in Harlem, he really had an influence on her. She was very influenced by the things she saw in the media. She wrote about the impact of the Rosenberg execution and how that made her physically ill. She wrote about wanting to say things and wanting to speak out, but realizing that as a woman speaking out in the 1950s during McCarthyism would have a backlash on her entire family, including, most importantly, her husband. Like, her political thought would ruin his reputation. I mean, just thinking about that level of sort of red domesticity really kind of shuddered her. But she found refuge in books. And that's what I love about her story, is that she found networks of publishers, journals like Monthly Review, books like The Wretched of the Earth. And she used these books as a platform to sort of feed herself and to help her survive what felt like a very closed off moment in U.S. history. I mean, and this is also a time where she had, you know, one child and twin boys fairly close in proximity. So she was a mother of three at a time where, you know, the labor of mothering, like one of the things I found in her home archive was a little book that said from the U.S. Government talking about best practices for raising your children, which is something that was mailed out to people in the 1950s as the domestic sphere became increasingly something to be mobilized in the Cold War. Right. So it wasn't until the Cuban Revolution where she was really excited about and felt like she could begin to speak out. So she travels to Cuba in the early 1960s under the umbrella of her family, the Murphy family, who were the originators and who were the founders of the Baltimore Afro newspaper, the Afro-American, which was one of the most well-circulated Black newspapers in that time period. So she goes to Cuba as a reporter for the Afro. Her husband supports her by doing the childcare labor while she's gone. And when she comes back, she's on fire. She's like, you know, she participates in something else I'm going to be writing about, which is a boycott of Christmas that was supported by the SCLC, Martin Luther King's organization, but really promoted on the ground by left grassroots organization. I think it's the Association of Afro-American Artists for Freedom, Ruby Dee Ozzie Davis, in the wake of the Birmingham church bombings, and say, well, Black children are being killed. We cannot support Christmas. And so she comes home from Cuba and she's like, she's not going to support Christmas. And her daughter just remembers like the horror of it all, right? Not Christmas. And it shifted. It took her politics to the kitchen table where she had to now explain why she was making this stance. And it propels her out in the world where she just became now part of the groups that and the organization and the people that she was speaking to her uncle about. You know, she was now in with Malcolm X, in with the Boggs. You know, she was a correspondent with Yuri Kochiyama. she just became a key part of this political world, all the while remaining a counselor for people. So that was her kind of trajectory in the 1960s and 70s. She wrote some of the leading political tracks about feminism. She wrote a well-received, a well-received essay with other women that she worked with, a letter to Vietnamese women from Black sisters that appeared in The Black Woman, Black Women in the Cities that appeared in The Black Woman that was widely anthologized. In this time period. So people may have read her work, this very well-known pamphlet where she's working with, some of the women she's working with are speaking back to brothers, as they, you know, as they're calling them, about why do poor single women need your input into birth control, our birth control choices, right? That's a widely anthologized pamphlet. And that's like, that's true who she was as an organizer and an activist. It's very plain spoken, although she was filled with all of this Marx and Lenin and Mao and, you know, W.B. Du Bois, she read so widely, including some of the key feminist tracts that were coming out at the time. But she wrote in sort of plain speak and was not above sprinkling in a little bit of profanity as needed. And she was like, you know, talking about the fact of, as she put it at the time, it doesn't resonate as well, I think, in our 2023 moment, but at the time she was talking about, you know, talking to women as if they're dick happy, for example. And what does that mean to sort of think about women as the owners of their own bodies and their own choices and their own decisions about reproduction? So that's who she was. I mean, she was a writer, she was a thinker. She continued to do counseling, especially during the New Left era of the movement, which was also, overlapping with Black Power and women's liberation. And when people, you know, the women were finding themselves partnered with men who were saying one thing in public and at home wanting ironing and dinner on time and sex on demand and all of that. So she helped women and men sometimes negotiate their internalized patriarch, we can say, to help them understand that what's happening in their relationship is not because two individuals can't get along, but it's because society is organized this way, because capitalism is doing that. And she gave people a language through her counseling to analyze their own lives. And that's, I think, one of her greatest legacies. So looking at her life, I follow her through the 70s and 80s, through the 1990s, when she is still in New York, still working in counseling, really sustaining people through the movements of that era. So I look at Reagan and Nicaragua and, you know, all of that. And it's just really a story of a woman who is taking on the world and helping people navigate that world in particular ways. So that's, you know, I love the project, as you can hear, probably. But that's kind of how, that's her transnational Black feminist life. You know, she's living it. She's encouraging and supporting other people to live and learn and do and be more in the world. And mainly through reading, through taking different action, and through organized political work.
She sounds like a fascinating individual. And just thinking about the multiple scales on which she was engaged, both in her community, in her service work, her theoretical work in her reading, so it's both praxis as well as theorizing, as well as her global travels, are really, I think, hard. It's hard to find people who are able to combine all of those. You mentioned Cuba, and you mentioned Nicaragua, and you mentioned a few other places. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about her Afro-Asian connections and solidarities.
Yes, she was very interested in Asia. She was very connected with what was happening in China, right? She's living through the Cultural Revolution. She's living through the Cuban Revolution, but also transformations in the U.S. role in Southeast Asia, in particular the U.S. war in Vietnam. And she takes those concerns, those political concerns that were animating so many movements. And she translates that into just a deep interest in the places. So she reads not just about what's happening in terms of current events in these moments, but she's like, she's got, you know, Asian literature. She's reading Vietnamese, you know, poetry. She's reading lots of things that are giving her a broad sensibility of understanding this place. And she's trying to make real connections. So one of my favorite things that she does, she drives these poor women who are not able to like afford to participate in all of these global coming together that really define this period. And she drives them across the border to Canada to be part of major conferences with Vietnamese women coming to speak to, you know, women from the U.S. So they become an informal delegation of people, including her daughter goes, who's a teenager at the time. And so she really allows for that international, right, to kind of think about how does New York kind of connect with Canada and what's happening with Canadian activism, and how can she sort of situate people in places where they can make those kinds of connections. So in particular, she was interested in a leader called Madame Binh, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, B-I-N-H, who was a Vietnamese woman revolutionary figure. And she used sort of the story of Madame Binh and the fact that she saw her at this conference and to come back with pamphlets and things like that, and kind of personalized the idea of the Vietnamese revolutionary guerrilla woman that was so canonized at that time in the image of the Vietnamese woman, you know, with the baby on the back, perhaps, you know, with very little equipment, fighting this war against this superpower. So her interest in Asia was very, very broad. And I think it challenges sometimes how we think about, like, what is Afro-Asia? What kind of connections were people making? She was interested in connecting with women in particular. She was interested in connecting on the ground. And I think through that interaction, I think thinking about, like, all of the places and spaces where people met up in this time period. We've got all of these conferences, these moments where people came together. And she participated in those moments, and she brought and expanded the circle of her political work to include moments like that. And it meant that she came back with new information, which was patriarchy as understood by Black American feminist women was quite different than a conversation topic than what was happening at that particular conference. You know, when the question of national liberation seemed to be the front and center one, and the question of male dominance seemed to be less resonant. Like, for example, in some of the literature that I've seen in some of the primary sources, you have the women, the U.S. women, questioning how can it be that the men are the interpreters for these revolutionary Vietnamese women? We want to hear their voice, we want to hear from them. Whereas for the Vietnamese women, it's a pragmatic thing. This is who can interpret for us, you know. It's a different understanding about feminism and power and gender. And she, I think, through her transnational activities and connections, she really saw the real. She saw and she felt what does solidarity require? What were some of the paths that intersected, and what were the paths that diverged in terms of how these women who were trying to be leaders in this revolutionary moment sort of visualized the future. And so she took those kinds of knowledges, I think, and it made her a more pragmatic leader. She didn't romanticize in particular ways, although I'm sure she continued to do some of that. But she really made that real, and such that she allowed for Black American women at the time to say to themselves, I'm not in a colonial situation, but somehow I see the same dynamic of power, let's say in my marriage, right? So she allowed people to kind of take this larger question of domination, power, voice, and to see it operating in their own lives, like kind of bring it home. And I think that those are the ways that we sometimes don't think about Afro-Asia and other moments in which people are crossing boundaries to build solidarity, to build, build power together.
So it's really interesting what you talk about in terms of how she encountered spaces where there were very different definitions and understanding of how feminism was practiced. Do you think that created barriers to trying to construct this transnational feminist solidarity that she was interested in developing?
I think it did. I think it created a sense of realism. She could no longer, which I think was, it was almost like a reality check. You could no longer say, well, Vietnamese women in this broad way and expect a particular line of thought. You had to understand that some women had challenged some elements of power. Some women were coming from a similar sort of trajectory politically, and others were not. And simply because they were in that category of Vietnamese women, that didn't make them necessarily the allies. Like, which Vietnamese women, let's say, I think became a more nuanced question that kind of came out of those engagements. I think the transnational Black feminism has demanded that question. It's not any woman just because you've come here from whatever place in the globe and you're representative of that, but what is your class background? Where are your political alliances? Who are your people? And those are the questions that I think she became more adept at asking, instead of saying, well, Vietnamese women believe and I'm in solidarity with Vietnamese women. I think a broader sense of that. And I think that that's an urgent question of Afro-Asian solidarity and other solidarities, even Palestinian America, you know, any solidarity moment you could think about, you have to ask those key questions.
It's fascinating because it raises, I think, a broader question that, as you say, applies to all kinds of solidarities, is that is the question of difference versus commonality, right? And so, you know, what brings us together, right? And where are the conflicts? It doesn't have to be conflicts, it could just be differences. But it seems to also raise the question for me about biography as a form of thinking about somebody like Pat Robinson in particular, who was clearly someone who was deeply engaged in collective projects. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about kind of how you see her as an exceptional individual, which she obviously was on so many levels, but also as someone at the same time who was very much a product of her time and was who she was because of her involvement with various communities.
Definitely. One of the things about Pat Robinson is that she wrote at a time where both ideals about individualism, ideals about individual were being really challenged from the New Left to the counterculture to different Black nationalist groups and things like that. And of course, most importantly, by the feminist movement. So she wrote many things collectively. She served as the voice or the, I guess because she had a degree and she had a certain level of social power, you know, sometimes it would be her name, but it was clear that she wrote with other people. And when she signed a lot of her writings, she would put there, you know, housewife and counselor. Like she was never trying to kind of escape that identity. So some of the things that she's written that have been the most well-known have been collectively written. She helped inspire people who were around her, young people, as young as 12, an intergenerational group of people who she was working with in New Rochelle to produce a book called Lessons from the Damned, which was signed by the damned. There was no individual author that was there to claim anything. And her name doesn't appear. She's associated with it because she helped people come together, ask questions, transcribe, used her network to try to get it in print, found a way in her correspondence with Monthly Review Press to have them excerpt some of that work into their journal. So she very much was kind of operating collectively. And she says this all of the time. In fact, there's a great quote from her where she says, "I don't matter. I'm just one molecule," right? She's just one of many. And I think that's why she's not as well known. She didn't necessarily want to be well known. So there is that tension in biography, like you're putting a spotlight on a figure and their actions. But in that process, are you exceptionalizing them? Are you sort of excising them from their context and things like that? So I hope to kind of navigate that when I'm writing about her, because she very much was somebody who was about the collective. She really was. And she shared a lot of her letters with her correspondence, I think, speak to just almost the love relationships among and between women. I think about the literature that's growing on women's friendships and just the role of friendship in, you know, political life. And so she befriended a lot of people. That was some of the work that she did. And when she was your friend, she was also your counselor. And she was not, you know, she was somebody, she was tough, we could say. She was exacting. She was not the person that was going to, you know, pat you on the back. She would hold up a mirror and talk to you about your bourgeois ideas, for example. You might leave her counseling session with a pamphlet and, you know, reading homework to be done, that kind of thing. So she very much, I think, wanted to play that role in people's lives. And I actually recently found a great letter, an email her daughter shared, where she was reflecting in her 70s about her life. And she was saying, "I was just trying to get people to look beyond the illusions of capitalism." And I just felt that was so powerful. And like, that's what she did. That's what she meant. And that's what was needed. I think we think about the leader who's up there with the microphone, usually a man, you know, whipping people into frenzies and mobilizing them for moments. But we don't think about the person who's trying to heal somebody, who's trying to have them be a little more critical about what's happening in the world and what they're participating in and what they're contributing to. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to do with the biography. Not just her, but her in relationship to the people and the world that she occupied. I feel like there's a whole world. Her bookshelves alone, I mean, so many booksellers, so many pamphlets, so many bookstores she went to. You can see stamped in there, you know, that she was in Harlem at Liberation Books, and she was here getting at the Black Feminist Bookstore. And it also makes you realize, from a 2023 perspective, that some of that stuff is gone. You know, a lot of that stuff is gone. And we think we've replaced it with websites, and now we have blogs, and now everyone can be an author, and we don't need these presses and things like that. But you realize an entire ecosystem, an entire network of exchange and knowledge is gone, has been disappeared. And when we ask ourselves, why don't people connect in the same way? Why are we so atomized? That is the reason. That is part of the reason. And I think that's what I'm trying to show with her biography, her in that network, her reading, you know, having relationships with books and booksellers and passing along books and pamphlets being important because they were cheap, and, you know, all of that stuff is what I'm trying to bring out.
That's really amazing. I mean, it's really, it sounds like a story of both understanding her as a trailblazer and as very much a part of a community and being embedded in a community. Robin, it has been such a pleasure talking to you, and I know that we are all eagerly awaiting for this biography to come out. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.